From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1787, when a group of young states was on its way to completing one of the most enduring, influential documents ever written, the U.S. Constitution. After roughly a decade of relative chaos with a collection of states only loosely connected with little cohesive structure and power, the leaders in those early American days decided to give a federal government some force. And of course, everyone agreed on all the details leading to the creation of the world's only perfect document requiring no revision. If only. Even in those early days, there was plenty of dissent. Much of it came from less wealthy citizens who were suspicious that the people making the rules were all rich and were all college educated, which was rare at the time, and were all men. The opposition was known as the Anti-Federalists, consisting largely of small farmers who didn't hold nearly as much power or commercial activity, and they feared strong government dominated by a wealthy ruling class. James Winthrop wrote that a large group of the United States would be like an empire, and quote, no extensive empire can be governed by Republican principles, end quote. Now, of course, the Federalists won that battle, but the document had plenty of problems that would lead to political strife and eventually war. And so maybe you've wondered, what would it look like if a brand new constitution had to be created today from scratch? How similar would it be to the original document? Tonight, the Central Library's Kate Gleason Auditorium is the site of a panel discussion and public event titled Creating the Constitution. And some of the participants are here this hour. And they include Jennifer Burns, head of the Science and History Division at the Central Library of Rochester and Monroe County. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Kent Gardner, principal and chief economist for the Center for Governmental Research. The rumor is you're doing a little less work with CGR these days. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, kind of my semi-retirement. So
are you like my dad, like 40 hours a week instead of 60?
Yeah,
something like that?
Not that bad, but, okay. But yeah, significantly less.
Well, nice to see you, Kent. And Adam Chodak is anchor and managing editor for WROC-TV. Sadly for him, I know he's nowhere close to retirement and is working many, many hours. Nice
that's
to
right.
see you.
It's good to see you. And I want to note that I drank some scotch last night, so I would have a better radio voice for you, for your show. So we all have to make sacrifices like our founding fathers.
Well, yes,
I
indeed.
Did that for you.
Jennifer, you and I didn't know.
I did have some wine last night.
See?
See?
Well, thanks. Thank you all for being here. And look, we are at a time, I think, where there's a number of hot sort of news items at the moment. And I don't want to dwell too long this hour on this question, but there's so many different places where you could look at our initial document and say, where is it imperfect? What should change? If we were starting over, what should change? Listeners who may be wondering about our programming for this week should know, and we'll tell you again as we get ready for tomorrow, the hearings in Washington, we're going to cover those live on this program. We'll just have, you're just going to hear everything live as it happens tomorrow with the Kavanaugh hearings that are still scheduled for the moment, at least, tomorrow. And some are wondering, you know, here's a case where Ruth Bader Ginsburg has essentially said she cannot retire. She wants to wait until there's a Democrat in the White House. She's been pretty close to explicit about that at the age, being in her mid-80s now. You've got Brett Kavanaugh nominated at the age of 53. If he isn't confirmed, Amy Coney Barrett is probably next off the Republican bench. She's 46 years old. We're talking many, many decades of service here. So let's start with a question here. Should we revise lifetime terms for Supreme Court justices? Kent Gardner.
I'd vote yes, absolutely. Let's go with rotating 18-year terms. I mean, 18 years is enough to guarantee that most of the people who got on the bench would be on pretty much until they retire. You don't get a position like that when you're young. I mean, not normally. So 18 years, I think, would provide some insulation from a political intrigue. I mean, that's why we have these lifetime terms. It's because we want the Supreme Court justices not to be worrying about their next job.
Should the current justices, I don't like to use this term, be grandfathered in?
I think the term is unavoidable, and I think the decision is as well, yes.
Okay. Tonight, that's just one of the many subjects. And again, we're going to work through the many. It's been written about for years. Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself created a little bit of a kerfuffle maybe 5 or 6 years ago. What exactly did she say? The Atlantic Monthly quoted her 2012. She told Egyptian revolutionaries in 2011, 2012 that she would not look to the U.S. Constitution if I were drafting a constitution in the year 2012. And that, of course, led people saying, how dare you? You're a Supreme Court justice. We have a little bit of a romance with it, don't we, Kent?
Well, it is. And, you know, some people have talked about it as this sacred document. You know, it's It's just interesting. It's a very complicated document. One thing people don't realize is that it's the result of, it was politics. It's a result of compromise. It was, a lot of pieces were hotly contested, as you pointed out in your intro. There were factions that pushing in different directions. And so it shouldn't surprise us that it is complicated and still controversial.
All right. So let me ask Jennifer what you hope to accomplish tonight. And this is a big deal for the library to get a chance to have this discussion, because I know that they're revisiting the founding era. It's a 3-year national initiative of the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History. So give me a sense for the framing of what you want to see tonight and how important this is to the library.
Well, first off, the Central Library has always had innovative programs such as this. But tonight's focus, in my opinion, is that the Constitution is not this static document that lives in the National Archives. It's a living, breathing force that affects our daily lives. And I don't think a lot of people think about that, how much it plays into our daily lives. So I'd like people to have, again, the library is about a free exchange of ideas. And so I'm hoping tonight for that free exchange of ideas in a civil, emphasizing civil discourse. So that's our goal.
Okay. And tonight, we've already had one listener, Herman in Brighton, said, what time? So tonight, Kate Gleason Auditorium.
7 p.m.
7 p.m.
Correct.
At the Central Library. And Adam Chodak, as an anchor and managing editor, as a journalist yourself, you've got to be a bit of a moderator. How much can you weigh in with what you would do? Or is this more about helping direct the flow of the conversation?
Well, I know we've been friends for years, and you don't know that I received a PhD in constitutional law.
I did not know that. I don't believe it.
Yeah, well.
I think that's fake news.
Well, actually, Timothy Nealand is the moderator.
Yeah, it's Tim Nealand. So so I guess I didn't mean to be asking, like, why are you there?
No,
because you don't have a PhD.
No, I actually
dig yourself out of this one.
I actually was thrilled when Jennifer asked, because I don't know a lot about various parts of history, but this particular 10-15 year period, as we've discussed many times, is one of my focal points. I absolutely love the 1770 to 1788 period. David McCullough really opened my eyes to just how incredible of a period that was. People were living on a knife's edge, and we can learn a lot about ourselves just by analyzing the different characters involved. So it's not just an historical exploration, but also a personal one for me, this particular era. So I feel privileged to be a part of this.
And when you have, as a journalist, encountered people who say, well, how dare you say that it's an imperfect document, that there's some kind of almost a religious devotion at times to it, I wonder how you sort of navigate some of that opprobrium.
Well, as Kent rightly said, this was a compromise document. It was such a compromise document, so heated at the time, that it required a second document attached to it by the Anti-Federalists, the Bill of Rights. So this was by no means fully agreed upon. They did not come down from a hilltop to bestow this upon the United States of America. And I think the Founding Fathers would be upset, actually, if they found out that we were revering the document as it was. Jefferson famously said that rebellion is sometimes a good thing. A little
blood of tyrants, a little blood of patriots.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously don't agree with that stance, but I think that point is that we shouldn't look at this as something that has to apply in its original form through the ages.
Adam, didn't Jefferson actually suggest that we do a new one every 20 years or something
19,
like that?
Every 19
oh,
years.
19.
I don't know why 19 was the year choice. He did. He did, though.
Because it'll take a year to formulate and then...
Every 90 years.
Now, I will say this, though. For as much as we can criticize various parts of the document and we can ask to change it, and we've seen changes over the years, I do want to emphasize how successful it has been as a document. And the longevity of our country is proof of that. So while we can pinpoint different areas we might want to change, I always do say that, let's be very clear, this was and is an incredible Constitution.
Okay, so listeners, if you want to join the conversation, we're going to work through the various points that are sort of the obvious gaps, or maybe the not-so-obvious gaps that you might see in constitutional law. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. And again, Jennifer, 7 p.m. tonight, Open to the public.
Open to the public, free.
Be there and join the discussion that will happen this evening. I'm going to, we've already got past the courts. We figured out the Supreme Court. You're welcome. one of the questions that certainly has become more pressing as the country grew was the question of representation. And The Atlantic in 2013 wrote a piece called The U.S. Needs a New Constitution, Here's How to Write It. One of the complaints was the Senate. So let me read from their piece on that. Quote, take the Senate. What started as a compromise to preserve states' rights lost even that pretext with the ratification of the 17th Amendment, which gave the people and not state legislatures the right to elect their representatives in the upper chamber. Today, the Senate is an undemocratic relic where 41 senators, representing just 11% of the nation's population, can use the filibuster to block almost anything and bring government to its knees. A single voter in Wyoming, a state with a mere 600,000 people, has the equivalent representation of 66 Californians. Unfortunate enough to live in a place with 38 million other people. The two-senator allotment to each state also makes it essentially impossible to change the makeup of the states or admit new ones like the District of Columbia. So that question on population, everybody gets two senators. Is that unjust, Kent?
It is unjust if you think that popular sovereignty is really what is necessary. If you think the majority rule ought to make all decisions, then perhaps we should just make the Census Bureau bigger and do everything by vote. But I guess I think that the point of the Senate, and perhaps it needs to be modified. I mean, some of the numbers you talked about are really staggering. But at the same time, it does acknowledge that there are different regional interests. We're a very big place as a nation. We are a place with significant diversity, and that diversity spans geography. And in a lot of ways, I think that the balance between the People's House, the House of Representatives, where everything's by population, and the Senate, where each of the states which have distinct interests get to have, the equal sway. I think that's in many ways brilliant.
Okay. Is that a hedge?
Sure, it's a hedge. Everything's a hedge. Right? I'm an economist. Nothing's certain.
Yeah, I'm going to say that as a New Yorker, I am envious of Rhode Island. What do you think, Mr. Chodak, what you see there?
Look, I tend to agree with Kent. I hear this all the time from both the left and the right, is that the government is broken. And I ask, is it? Is it really? I mean, yeah, it doesn't perhaps legislate as efficiently as we would like, and there are certain aspects that we could obviously do better in. At the same time, I have to go back to the Constitution and the Founding Fathers. Did they build the Senate to be obstructionists in a way, to kind of slow things down? Is this in fact working somewhat like it was intended to? And so, yes, we can go to the numbers and proportionality and all that, and that can be adjusted. But I wonder if the general structure and the general operations that we're seeing is kind of supposed to happen.
It wasn't an accident, right? This was done on purpose. No one, I mean, the original states had the same kind of disparities in population that we have now. Maybe not quite as extreme as, Wyoming to California today, but nonetheless, I mean, this wasn't just a mistake.
And on the subject of welcoming obstruction, it is certainly true that in the 1780s, the whole point was to have a weak, that really had no federal government. It was just sort of a loose collection of states. They couldn't even be taxed by a federal government. Yeah. Eventually, they realized, maybe we need a little bit more than this.
And the reader that Jennifer put forward is very interesting because there was one particular author in there, Jennifer, I don't know if you remember this, where he encouraged people not to use the word weak for the Articles of Confederation, but rather the word limited, because they didn't see that as a weakness. They saw that as a strength, to keep a lot of the powers in the states.
That little piece of nuance has a great little delicious bit of history.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
Weak and limited are very different ideas.
Exactly.
But something limited is a good or strong concept.
Right. I mean, and the Constitution is, looks at limiting certain people's powers. So limiting is a good thing in that respect. So
I'm reading so the first remark from a listener is Don, who says, parliamentary systems work for most other democracies. Why not us? Well, we're not a democracy. We're a republic. Are you going to parse that one, too?
No, I agree, and I think we should get to the issue of parliamentary systems and some of the weaknesses and strengths of parliamentary systems versus ours. I mean, I think that eventually I'm sure we'll get to that tonight, but there is a very strong executive in our current system, and we're seeing what that can sometimes lead to. And parliamentary systems at least have the virtue of being renewable at the drop of a vote. You know, within Parliament. And I think that that is a real strength in many ways. It also, and that's the other issue I think I hope we'll get to tonight, is to talk about how our current system creates a monopoly for the two major parties. So the party of incumbency runs the nation. The party of incumbency runs most of our states.
Which is very interesting because Washington warned against that. He
exactly.
was very much anti-party. Upon mm-hmm. leaving office, he was very clear, let's try to avoid partisanship. Yes, he was mm-hmm. a Federalist, but he was very wary of where we are now.
Exactly. Yeah, he cautioned against that.
And throughout history, it's not a surprise that the wealthiest people sort of write the rules. So even in the creation of a constitution that sought to protect against overly obstreperous power and the, I mean, everybody was scared of the next King George. And so I understand that, but there's a complaint that take the Anti-Federalists all the way on down throughout American history, that it's still too elitist, that it's not a democracy, it's a republic, that you're electing representatives to vote for you, and that even when we elect presidents, we needed an electoral college. And mm-hmm. John Green, who is an author and a sometimes historical explainer in a piece on the creation of the United States, said, if the Electoral College was such a damn good idea, why hasn't anybody else copied it? He said, it's an anachronism that should be put down.
I was telling Kent and Adam beforehand, I taught a class of young adult New Americans, and I, as part of this grant, and had them write their own constitutions. And something that they could not wrap their heads around was the Electoral College. They did not understand it, and they looked to us as this model of democracy. But when they look at who wins the popular vote, that's not who wins. And it was so confounding for them. And it was very difficult to explain, you know, why we do that and justify its purpose. Although Kent will justify its purpose.
Yeah,
for
Kent's going to take a stab at it. Are you a defender of the Electoral College?
I actually am. I'm probably the only person in America.
How did I know that? Okay. No, you're not the only one in America, but let's work through why you think it still has a value.
I mean, first, let's recognize what the Constitution did with the Electoral College. The Constitution said that first it was a very elitist purpose for the Electoral College. So let's start with that.
Yeah. And
that was to say, we're going to have these individuals elected by the states who really have the power to elect the president. So if, you know, a demagogue is up for the position, then we will have these sober, mature people spread all across the country, therefore, somewhat immunized from popular sentiment that might be locally focused, and that those individuals can then make a prudent choice. So, but we got rid of that a long time ago. So, but still, if you take a look at the Constitution, it allocates electoral votes to the states and lets the states decide how to allocate those votes. That's where the problem comes in, because the states, in order to maximize their power as a state, nearly all have decided that they will assign give all of their electoral votes to the candidate wins
a majority.
Not all
states do that.
Two separate, and those do a majority by a congressional district. What is it, Iowa?
Maine, I think?
And Maine, yeah. But almost all the states, certainly all the big states, allocate every single electoral vote to the candidate that wins a majority. Now, if you take that provision away and you say that the electoral votes are going to be allocated according to the popular vote, frankly, the election comes out pretty much the same. It would have been Clinton 270 and Trump 268. That's assuming that you only vote for the top two, only the top two get electoral votes. But what's interesting about that is if you move simply only, I think it's 350,000 votes in either Texas or in New York, Trump still wins the Electoral College if you're allocating electoral votes according to the popular vote by state.
Why do it by state? Because again, in the next election, when Trump beats Michael Avenatti by one vote in Texas and one vote in New York, he is going to have all of the electoral votes in this country and a two-vote national vote lead over Michael Avenatti. I will be watching from Mars.
Yes, but
Canada.
But I'll push one step further. The other thing that the Electoral College does that I think, again, it gets back to my admiration for the Senate, is that the electoral votes are the number of representatives plus senators. So in a very small way, it provides a little bit more power to those less populous states and shifts the power away from the states that have all the people. So, you know, I understand there's an argument in favor of just doing it by popular vote, but that there is a concern, I think, that we'll have candidates that are particularly popular in New York or in California, and perhaps the rest of the states might have, and those particularly those rural states, less populous states, might have a different perspective, and we need to maybe tilt the table just a little bit in their direction, which is all the Electoral College does.
Well, I'm all for at least respecting that that impact could have a deleterious effect in many ways, not just visits during a campaign, but also policy priority, et cetera.
Right.
I think those are very legitimate concerns that many rural Americans would have.
But winner take all is a terrible, terrible mistake on the part of for the nation. It may make sense for the states, but it doesn't make sense for the nation. I mean, we in New York actually were spared a bunch of campaign ads, of course, in the general election. But you know, no one really thinks
actually,
that
I would like
play.
Them.
You'd like to see those ads.
Well, yeah. Well, of course, I work in commercial television.
Oh, I forgot.
It pays for salary. That's why
Please.
I got out of commercial television.
I love your idea.
I'd have Chris Collins and Nate McMurray pay my salary, and I was done with that.
That's right.
Okay. Any thoughts on the Electoral College before I move on to another interesting proposal here?
Yes. Pass.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, I want to get back to the Senate. Larry Sabato, who is a political observer and a professor, wrote a book in 2008 called A More Perfect Constitution, Why the Constitution Must Be Revised. And he had a number of ideas, but I want to key in on one that includes the Senate, but it also includes this, again, rather romantic idea we have for past presidents. It's interesting when George W. Bush was president, how loathed he was on the left. But now many Democrats are going, Michelle Obama passed him a mint, and he's not Donald Trump. And, you know, so there's this softening that happens. And so here's what Sabato said, and I think it happens to Larry Sabato, too. He says the Senate should be expanded to give more populous states at least a bit more representation. It should also include national senators, a new category. All former presidents and vice presidents, and maybe others, and high-ranking retired members of government, whose job it would be to guard national interests over parochial ones.
And they're those retired Supreme Court justices once we put them on an 18-year
Exactly. Term. Is that the most elitist thing ever, or is that wise?
I like the idea.
Jennifer's going to go with elitist.
I am. And why someone thinks that just because a president has retired and is no longer in public service that they don't have self-interest.
It's fair. Great point.
They still have self-interest. So, if you use Bush, is his family still in oil? You know, is it still in, so I don't think necessarily that they become these neutral, objective people just because they're out of office.
Well, I do think that a president or a Supreme Court justice is sitting in the seat for a long time, being confronted all the time with all the push and pull of the of national concerns and national issues, and that would give a person in that position a different perspective. And certainly, where you stand depends on where you sit. And, if George Bush is still sitting in Texas, I understand the point. But I do think that that it lends a perspective that might be different. But I haven't thought much about it.
Well, here's my rebuttal. My rebuttal on that would be whether it's Bob Corker or Jeff Flake, the Republicans who have been most willing to be vocal and speak out against, and this is just one example. This isn't about Trump per se, but this is just the example of the moment. Who are the Republicans who are actually speaking out vociferously against this president? They're the ones who are retiring. So they don't really have as much to lose. Now, maybe they're retiring
But
regardless,
who knows? Yeah, right.
It's safer for them politically to do that. So when we finally get, the patina of politics, and we get the stench of politics off somebody, the team sportism, it does seem to soften them. Whatever you think about George W. Bush, and I'm not sitting here I'm not going to adjudicate every presidency. Whatever you think about Barack Obama, whatever you think about Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton, Reagan when he was alive post-presidency, whatever you think about those people, there is a bit of a less of a team sport aspect because they're not in that arena anymore, and I think that's valuable. Keeping them in that arena by giving them power in this new extra Senate kind of keeps them kind of grinding out the politics, and I'd rather have their wisdom post-politics. That's one of my rebuttals.
Yeah, again, I'd buy that. I think that makes a lot of sense. It's certainly worth considering.
Okay. Adam?
I just go back. My hero in this world is George Washington, and I go back to him. You know, first, let me just say this.
The guy who said political parties, that's where you're going with this.
Well, not just that. He handed, I think literally, actually, the sword back to the legislative body after he was done. And he said, I'm done. Like, I'm going back. I'm going to live out my life. And they tried to pull him back in for the election in 1800. And he said, no, mm-hmm. no, this is your turn now. I have my life to live. I think he lived two more years, but I have my life to live. You have to go do what you're going to do. And I think that there's some value in that because it really helps further cement the notion that power is passed down. I don't think we should try and create any type of myth that power can stay with one person or one group until the end. So I think conceptually, I don't love that idea.
Okay.
Yeah, that's because that's very monarchy-esque.
It does. I'm not a big fan of lifetime anything, to be honest, when it comes to holding power. And that is one of the most extraordinary things a political leader has done in this country, was Washington could have effectively become a monarch.
Absolutely, without question. He had the army at his command and loyalty of the people. He could have easily become a tyrant.
And he could have created any number of avenues to explain it away. Well, just another term, just for now.
Look, Hamilton, a fellow Federalist, was pushing for lifetime appointments for the executive branch.
Yeah, thank God that guy lost.
So, well, he lost big time.
Yes.
So I think that, and a side note to all this, people always debate who was the best president. I think, hands down, you have to say George Washington because he set the bar for the transfer of power. Otherwise, who knows?
Yes, as we look at other democracies around the world, their supposed democracies, I mean, that really is the test. You know, does the elected leader actually hand over the reins at the end of his or her term?
Yeah, because at the end of the day, the Constitution is just a piece of paper.
Good news is we'll never have a problem with that in this country now. Tom in Brighton.
Oh, look,
on the phone.
I hit the cough button.
Yes. Tom next. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. So I certainly agree there's opportunities to change the Constitution. But I'd like to bring out one proposal that's been offered that we just have to think more than two or three times about it. That's going to a parliamentary-type system as opposed to the division of powers that we currently have with a strong executive. Just in view of our country's history, we went to war, you know, over the Civil War. And I think if we had a parliamentary system at that time, it would have inhibited the North from engaging in that civil war, or certainly inhibited the whole country, because you'd have too many opportunities for groups of states to prevent the war from occurring. Especially, the reason we went to war was the determination by the executive at that time, Abraham Lincoln, to pursue it, and to, of course, eventually to free the slaves, but mostly to pursue a very costly war where a lot of bloodshed, a lot of blood was lost, and it was only his determination that kept that going. A second instance would be the First World War. I think if we had a parliamentary system, it would have also delayed our entry into that war. And even for the Second World War, although if we were attacked by the Japanese as we were, that eventually would have brought even a parliamentary system into the war. But I think a parliamentary system short of that attack would have inhibited us entering even the Second World War. The only instance where I think we all agree it would have been good to have a parliamentary system to stop entry into a war was the Iraq War of 2001 or 2002.
All right, Tom, with a lot there. So thank you for the phone call. And again, 7 p.m. tonight at the Kate and Gleason Auditorium at the Central Library. Mm-hmm. And if you want to weigh in on with any thoughts, now, Tom might not have heard, we kind of hit the subject of a parliamentary system earlier. I'm sure that will come back up tonight. Tim Nealon is on the line with us now, who's going to be moderating, chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. Too late, Tim. We solved the whole thing.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah.
I'll just listen to the podcast tonight, and it'll be all set.
Well, I'll tell you how we solved it. No, you're going to have to be there tonight. In fact, you're moderating tonight. Tim, these discussions have been happening really since the forming of this republic, which is a healthy thing. Am I naive to think that right now there's more interest in this subject than there often is? Are you sensing that, whether among your students or elsewhere?
No, I absolutely think that there's, with all of the sort of sense of crisis going on out of Washington, that the people really are interested in reshaping the Constitution and having conversations about what the flaws are and what needs to be done. And I think just as you're having these engaging conversations here, that this program is being spread out through all 50 states and libraries. And I think that this is exactly the kind of dialogue we do. Because, again, the thing is, I think we need to remember we've been here before in terms of this sort of struggle. From the beginning, we've had a crisis every generation about what the meaning of the Constitution is. But it's healthy to remember that we've somehow managed to use this instrument to negotiate those crises.
I will also say, Tim, and I'm very sensitive about representation and conversations about issues that impact all Americans. When I say all Americans, not just wealthy and elite Americans. Right now, we're sitting here, and all the participants in this particular conversation are white. Our document did a horrendous job at understanding what equality was supposed to look like in its early days, despite a lot of good rhetoric. And so if we were starting from scratch, I would hope it would be a true representation of the people who make up this remarkable land of states. And I wonder now if you think that we are on any sort of a better avenue to sort of remedy those mistakes of the early days when the Constitution was written, Tim.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, certainly, again, history will show you that there has been progress over time over some of these issues. But we still have an incarceration nation. We still have people who are disenfranchised because of something that may have happened in their youth, right? And we still have people whose voices are not being heard. We still have people who feel that they're being silenced by certain elected officials, perhaps at the highest levels of government, who don't want to hear from them. And so I think this is where we need to remember, we need to be attentive to the fact that there are a variety of voices, and we can't just listen to the echo chamber of social media, that we need to go out and seek those other voices, even if they make us uncomfortable.
Well, next hour, we're going to be talking to Carlotta Walls, one of the Little Rock Nine, from 1957, when desegregation was happening, or at least when there was an attempt to make that happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, our history is still very, very fresh. So let's do this. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back to more of your questions that have come in via email. And if you want to call the program as we talk about changes, possible changes to the U.S. Constitution, what would you do now if you had to fill in any gaps or answer questions or make changes? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. We're coming right back here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're honored to be joined by Carlotta Walls Lanier. Carlotta Walls was one of the Little Rock Nine, nine black students who in September of 1957 just wanted to go to class. Of course, as you know by now, they were greeted by angry mobs, a racist governor who didn't want to end segregation. Her story and how she sees the country now, next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Barb writes to us and says, do Connections listeners want to slow down and literally write by hand the Constitution as a method of understanding it? If the answer is yes, listeners can join us at the Irondequoit Public Library on any or all of the first Thursdays of October, November, and December from 6 to 8 p.m. That's going to follow the practice of a New York City artist named Morgan O'Hara. Participants gather to simply copy the actual words of the Constitution and then reflect and question. So thank you, Barb. Interesting. So there's an opportunity to kind of get up close with the Constitution, and there's a great chance tonight to listen to a panel discussion with Tim Nealon, who's on the line with us from Nazareth College, Kent Gardner from the Center for Governmental Research is here, Adam Chodak from WROC-TV, and Jennifer Burns from the Public Library, the Central Library of Rochester and Monroe County. Tonight, 7 p.m.
Correct.
If our listeners are just joining us, what's going on tonight?
7 p.m. panel discussion about creating the Constitution. We'll be discussing potential amendments to the Constitution. It'll be a civil, lively debate, and it's free and open to the public, and parking is free on the street after 6 p.m., so no excuses.
All right, I'll get back to your phone calls in a minute. I see the phone ringing, but before we do that, Let me just read one more section from this very interesting article in The Atlantic about the problems and the possible solutions to the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution. They read about this. Any constitutional lawyer can point out the places of the Constitution that need work. How much authority should presidents have in the case of a national emergency? Can they lock up Japanese Americans, as FDR did? Do individuals have a right to privacy in an age of high-tech snooping by a national security agency? How is power really divided between the states and the federal government? The list of questions goes on, but the Constitution doesn't answer them, so judges have had to fill in the blanks. Where modern constitutions in other nations get specific, we get judicial activism, end quote. That's from The Atlantic. It's an interesting point, because if you go back to what Thomas Jefferson said, assuming that every couple of decades any nation would have to rewrite its foundational laws and constitutional documents, well, we really haven't done that. We've amended and revised as we've gone. Yeah, that's right. I mean, Thomas Jefferson was not really, for as smart as he was, he didn't know very much about the internet. So there's a lot to learn as we go along. And then the question becomes, if there are gaps, is it filled in by judicial activism? I think that's a fair concern.
It is, and I actually don't think that the way we've done this is a problem. I think that it allows you to put something into the Constitution, particularly a Constitution that is as difficult to amend as ours. And you're really locked and loaded for whatever that language says and however it gets interpreted. And, there are some pieces of the Constitution, that make us concerned. I mean, we could talk about the Citizens United decision, for example, the whole notion around campaign finance that money is speech. And, if we're talking about amendments, that would be one that I might be willing to address. But by and large, I think that allowing, because what, we're not talking about, you call it judicial activism. I think it's the judges making decisions.
Well, it's judicial activism if it's not
if
your
it's
team.
If it's not your team.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, then it's activism.
The other guys are activists.
Otherwise, it's just wisdom from the bench.
Well, it's actually, more specifically, though, it is, so we've got this thing in the Constitution that says X, Y, or Z. And someone comes to us with a very specific case and says, well, does it mean X or does it mean Y? And, if we define the Constitution, if we lock down the Constitution so that absolutely every eventuality is covered, I think that really doesn't leave us the kind of flexibility.
Okay, so you think these gaps are natural and you don't really see a problem with them?
I don't. I mean, there are holes I'd plug, but realistically, I think the notion of having a relatively short, small document, which ours is relative to many other constitutions, and allowing circumstance and the judicial system to divine what, how that applies in specific circumstances is really not a bad system.
Okay, Jennifer?
I think the bigger issue is, failing to look at the historical context of it. Like if you look at the Second Amendment, when that was written, there was no organized military.
I'm glad you brought this up with only 10 minutes left.
Sorry.
So we didn't spend
Sorry.
No, it's a great point, though.
There was no organized military. So if England decided they wanted to invade us again, it was, you and your neighbors, you were the military.
That's right.
So, but I think failing to look at what was going on in the time, what was of the founding fathers and, what their rationale was, does that still apply? And again, I don't think they intended for this document to never be revised. So I would just say, looking at it, what was going on in the country at that time that led them to say the things that they said and how they said it.
Yeah, I think that's an important point here. And I'll go back to the analysis I saw from John Green on the Second Amendment. He did point out that in some of the original writings about 2A, the people putting it together said it was a right of the citizens to be even better armed than the national government or whatever sort of national body would be, so as to obviously protect against tyranny. Well, that would mean today you've got a right to, as he says in the piece, your own drones and nuclear warheads.
Everybody gets a tank.
If we are being consistent with the original intent.
Well, once again, and this feeds the position I took on your original question, Evan,
yeah,
is that we were very specific in the Second Amendment. We put some words in there that we are now stuck with. And
some commas, by the way. One of the worst written things you've ever seen.
Yeah. So, to have a constitution that is more specific, has more specific language, and is longer, I think, would give us all kinds of problems like this.
Okay. Adam?
Yeah. Between Jennifer and Kent, you basically took my two ideas. If I were to recreate the Constitution, I wouldn't do much, but I would definitely address campaign finance. I don't think they foresaw what would happen there necessarily. I would also probably work on clarity within the Second Amendment, but I don't mean that like from a left or right, because I don't want to. I think if we were to open up a constitutional convention, unfortunately, sitting here now, we're idealists and we would do this and do that, but you'd have the political parties trying to solidify their own ideology within the Constitution. That's what would happen. So it's not like this would be some kumbaya moment for us. So I think when you go into the Second Amendment, let's figure out where we are as a country with the modern technology that we have and figure out what should be allowed, what should be a right, and what shouldn't.
Okay. And Tim Nealon, when it comes to gaps and questions of power, the one concern I have, and not to play sort of the both sides game, because I know that sort of irks people from modern journalists, but I'm going to do that here, and I'm going to say that President Obama used executive order to get around sort of a recalcitrant Congress at times, and used it pretty effectively. And a lot of his supporters said, "Well, good, they're recalcitrant. They are." Obstinate to the point of just for partisan gain, and he should do that because he can. Now, the same sort of executive power is in the hands of someone they don't like. And the gaps are being filled usually by whatever party has the power, and it's resulted, I think, in a lot more executive power in recent years. And sometimes you like it, and it depends on if your team's in power, but I'm not sure that's a good trend, or maybe I'm misreading it. What do you think, Tim?
No, I think you're right, and I think here's the issue, is that you've got to understand that there really should be gaps. I think Ken is right, that that if you look at the New York State Constitution, God help you, that thing is chock full of very specific elements that you really don't need in there. And that's what happens with state constitutions. The Constitution can be amended. And if you look at the history of the amendments, they come in spurts. They were happening like every generation was going through and saying, you know what, we need to do this. And so we're going to amend the Constitution and clear up these gaps. And we'll have direct election of senators. And golly, an income tax sounds great. And women should get the vote and we shouldn't drink alcohol. We do have those amendments. We have those spurts over time, but we really haven't done much. It's been, you know, nearly 50 years since there was a real amendment. And I'm not talking about that, the 27th Amendment that was kicking around for 200 years. And I think it's time to amend the Constitution. I think, you know, time might be right for an equal rights amendment, right? I think that there are pauses that we sort of amend the Constitution. We figure out what that means. It used to be Congress, but you're right, now it's more the courts. And in the vacuum of Congress or the courts, it's the president. And that's the thing about, you know, sharing powers and having shared authority, is that one branch often has powers that you might think only belong to the other. But yes, Congress makes the law, but who gets to interpret it? Well, it could be the courts or it could be the president through executive orders, signing statements, or some of these other issues. But we could clarify that in an amendment to the Constitution. I don't think that would be bad. We had an opportunity to have a New York State Constitution revision, but everybody feared what would come from that, and they voted that down.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. Val in Honeoy Falls next. Go ahead, Val.
Well, you may have already talked about this, but first off, let me say that I fully agree that the Constitution needs the gaps it has, and it needs it needs to be very difficult to amend. And I would also say that I would hope whatever version of the Constitution keeps the strikeouts and the language of amendments like the 20th that were rescinded, because that testifies to the living activity of the Constitution as history unfolds. But the part that I would submit for change is the exception clause in the 13th Amendment. It allows slavery for convicted criminals. And in the South, it led to the travesty of the convict leasing program, in which particularly former slaves were arrested for small crimes and then leased out to serve as they did as slaves. And that's a part of the history that I grew up in, even though I'm from the Western South in Texas. But I think it would totally change our current approach to imprisonment to eliminate the slavery clause, the slavery exclusion in the 13th Amendment, and to allow that amendment simply to ban slavery in all of its forms. So that's my comment.
Val, thank you.
I'll listen.
All right, I was going to start with Tim Nealon. Go ahead, Tim.
Just a great insight that he has on the 13th Amendment. And yeah, exactly. I think, you know, we're already thinking consequences of crime, and we've talked for decades about changing the legal system. And so maybe there's ways that we could amend the Constitution or clarify the Constitution. Once again, I think Congress could step in and take care of some of this without necessarily having to amend the document. But Congress is not doing its job.
Okay. Chris writes to us and says, a solution to the Electoral College is expanding the House. The smallest states still get one rep based on census, and larger states receive seats apportioned based on that unit. California would go from 53 to 66 members, and the Electoral College delegation would go from 55 to 68.
I believe it's one representative per 30,000 people.
Ken, you look horrified.
Well, I don't understand the proposal. I mean, the House is already established on the basis of population, and we, you know, redo that every 10 years, and then the Electoral College, you get the number of representatives plus the number of senators. So, I suppose if you're talking about giving fractional representatives to the very small states, that seems rather peculiar. I mean, I suppose it would be possible to get, you know, to even that out, but that really isn't a real serious problem. We only have a few states that have really small populations. I mean, the House is really not a problem, and in my view, I just don't see what we'd be fixing.
Okay, Tim?
He may be talking about the fact that Congress voted to limit the number of seats in the House to 435 after the 1910 census. So it may be that what this person is proposing is that just go back to setting a standard so that you organically grow the House based upon the actual population, which is what happened right up until after 1910. So maybe that's it. And then, of course, that would expand the congressional delegation in places like California and, of course, change the Electoral College.
All right, down to our last few minutes here, and a conversation tonight about the Constitution, creating the U.S. Constitution. And Jennifer Burns, who's head of the Science and History Division at the Central Library of Rochester and Monroe County, will be there. How much do you think this conversation needs to be about starting from scratch, and how much needs to be about the experience from the 1780s, and as you've said several times here, understanding the context and the reasoning behind what they did then?
Well, I think you can't, you know, I don't think you can go and recreate a constitution until you understand how a constitution is created, and you can't identify what will be right with your constitution until you understand what was wrong or what you perceive as wrong with the original Constitution. So I think they're in tandem. I mean, you have to know the history of it in order to create a better, you know, more perfect document.
Okay. Kent Gardner, there's been some political debates about whether, you know, Governor Cuomo says this country was never that great. And, you know, then there's this back and forth about what he means by that. Clearly, to people who didn't have the power and don't necessarily have the power now, there have been many, many instances in which this country has fallen short of the ideals that were written, even by the founders. Understanding that, is it a great document?
I think it is a document that has proven its worth over the years. I think there has always been a risk of demagoguery in the presidential office.
Or governor's office. I think what you're wondering is he running for president? But okay.
Yeah, right. But I think that's been a concern. And if you take a look at a lot of the countries that have mimicked our Constitution, if you look at South America, many of which adopted a Constitution very much like the United States Constitution, they have really slipped into a near tyranny in terms of their presidents. They've had presidents that have been, I think, really have had dictatorial powers. And so I think that's always been a risk with our system, and somehow we've managed to avoid it until now, maybe.
Back to the gridlock thing, I think you wisely pointed out that the founders always thought it should be hard to get things done.
Yeah, and let me just make very clear, if it hasn't been already, is that the Constitution, woven within it, is racism with the three-fifths clause. Let's be very honest about that. What's been beautiful about the Constitution and us as a people, and I think more us as a people, is that we changed it. First with the 13th, as the caller said, it didn't go all the way, and then the 14th. So what has been beautiful about the document is its ability to change with the times. And that's what this discussion is about, is where do we go from here? Are we going to change it further? what perhaps changes are we going to see 2 generations from now or 100 years from now? It's just going to be very interesting. I'm looking forward to this discussion very much.
And Tim Nealon, final thoughts from you. Go ahead, Tim.
Come out tonight and we'll talk some more about this. This is a great topic, and I look forward to meeting the panelists tonight and moderating this.
I'm always amazed at how we spend 51 minutes in an hour and we solve the biggest problems that the world has.
You're welcome.
But thank you, Jennifer. To the extent that we missed anything, and we missed a lot, they're going to have a lively discussion tonight. It's always a great opportunity to be down there at the library engaging in events like this. Tonight, 7 p.m. at the Kate Gleason Auditorium. Which is where, if they've never been there, Jennifer?
115 South Avenue in the new building, not the old Rundle building, on the first floor.
By the way, I've mistaken those buildings before.
Yeah, so, you're not alone.
Yeah, well, thank you for being here, Jennifer. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Kent Gardner from the Center for Governmental Research. Always fun to mix it up. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
And Adam Chodak from WROC-TV. Nice to pull you away from reading David McCulloch for just an hour.
It's my pleasure. That's my Scotch voice.
There you go. Yeah. Thank you very much. Tim, I know it's been a busy day and you're back on campus. Thanks for taking the time for the program and see you tonight.
All right.
Tim Nealon from Nazareth College joining us. All right, much more connections straight ahead.